in the classes that Tatiana has taught so far. I'm not going to read her bio just because it's in your book and you can read it. I just want to introduce her as my friend and roommate and the amazing person that she is. Tatiana and I were roommates back in college at George Wythe College, and she's had an amazing impact on my life and the lives of so many others. She's an amazing mentor, friend, mother, and what I love is that Tatiana is always, always learning. Every time I talk to her, I'm just like, holy cow, okay, I gotta hit the books again. Like, she's so inspiring, and I'm super excited for tonight's topic. I specifically called her and asked her to come speak at our conference, knowing the things that she's studying right now, the things that she's been looking into, because I think it directly affects all of us in the homeschool world, and she's doing amazing research to write a book and to bring to light a lot of things about education, and I'm just so excited for it. So I'll turn the time over to Tati. We will also sing God Bless America at the very end. Okay, I'm the last speaker and everyone's tired. So before we get started, I actually have a very heavy, meaty presentation, and I'm like, this is the wrong time to give this. I should have done it in the morning. So before we get started, I need everybody to reset your automatic system and get to a better place of homeostasis. So everyone, take your shoulders and roll them back as far as you can go. Like, try to pinch the two blades together in the back. Okay, you see when you do that, you are actually opening up your lungs so you can breathe. Now, no, I'm serious. Phil, are you getting more breath? Now, try to take as big of a breath as you can. Put your hand on your stomach and try to make your hand move while your shoulder's out. Feel it as big as you can through your nose and out your mouth. One more. I know that's super awkward, but breathing like that actually helps reset your brain. And I'm working on an idea, and I really want to present it to you, and I hope you can be present with me. I'm going to make it interesting, though, but this is the idea that I'm working on. It's called suffocated. Instead of suffocated, suffocated. Okay. The last time that I was in Idaho, I'm currently living in Louisville, Kentucky, was March of 2020. We came to come visit our awesome friends, the Louisvilles. This is my daughter in the potato, what do you call this, like a potato mountain? It's a mountain of potatoes. So we came here and then went to the sheep operation and saw all the sheep. It was so, so fun. But it was March 2020. We were crossing the border between Utah and Idaho, and everyone's like, you're crazy, Tati, you can't go visit Megan, there's a plague. And I'm like, no, we're just getting, hey, you know what, I just had a baby, we're moving to Kentucky, this is the last time we're going to see each other, we're just going to do it. Well, right after we got back from visiting Megan, they shut down the border. And then a few weeks later, sorry, I'm trying not to get emotional with this, April 1st, which is an ironic date, I woke up really, really early in the morning, and I went to nurse my baby, who was very, very little. And at the time, we were living in my parents' basement apartment, and I sat down on the couch, and my father was there because he had just been let go from his job for 25 years. And he was working on a project, and so it was really early in the morning, and I got up to nurse my baby because I didn't want my toddler waking up, and he looked at me and he said, I think my brother killed himself last night. And I said, Dad, that is the most morbid, horrible, evil April Fool's joke you could ever come up with, and it's not okay. And he's like, no, I really think my brother killed himself last night. This man right here is my Uncle Blaine, and you can see him right here next to my father. My father's the one in the glasses, and this is his brother right there standing next to my beautiful abuela, and this little baby is me, and my older sister. He never married. He was autistic, and he struggled, but he was brilliant. He was a brilliant mind, and he is a lawyer, and he was a really successful lawyer, but he never married, and he lived in Colorado, and we lived in Utah for most of my life, and we called him Santa Blaine, because every Christmas he would come to visit, and he would bring the best food, he'd make the best Mexican food you've ever had, and he would bring the best presents, and it was so much fun, and he would come visit us, and we loved hanging out with him, we loved playing games with him, he was such an awesome part of our life. Prior to COVID hitting, he fell, and it wasn't healing. And so he decided when COVID hit, he was going to have to go to the doctor. And he was too scared to go to the doctor because he didn't want to die from COVID. So he decided to take his own life. And my family had to break all kinds of protocols so that we could bring him home and hold a memorial. And then we had to wear masks. And nobody could see us mourn. And we weren't allowed to celebrate his life or pack up his things or take care of anything. And nobody saw us mourn. And I felt like I was suffocated. And I asked myself, why is this happening? Why are we doing this? What is happening to us that this horrible thing happened that my uncle was so scared of all the hype that he'd rather do this than go to the doctor? And what I learned is that COVID hysteria destroyed people's lives, but COVID was also deadly. 18 months later, my mother-in-law had a massive heart attack and was in a coma for 3 weeks and almost didn't wake up because of COVID. So COVID was deadly and the hysteria was deadly. It was this dichotomy that we can't deal with. And an entire generation of children, which is you, suffered. You all suffered. We all suffered. And I got to thinking, and as I was thinking about it, if we had another COVID situation, how would we handle it? And I got to realize we wouldn't do anything different. If this were to happen again, I think the same thing would happen. And I got to thinking, why? Why? Why would we act this way? And I realized it's because our education system has only taught us how to be a robot. It has not taught us how to think, and therefore we cannot act. We can only react. Because if you don't know how to think, you can only react. So when we're confronted with a crisis again, the American population will react just like we reacted to the fear the first time. In Stephen Covey's book, he talks about education is the gap between stimulus and response. That's all education is. And the more education you have, the wider that gap goes. But we're not an educated populace. Then I got thinking some more. And why does this matter? Because we're a republic. And a republic is run by the people, right? And this is a really fascinating quote that really blew my mind. So John Stuart Mill is the author of a book called On Liberty. And he was a populist. He was supporting people being able to rule themselves in the late 1800s. And he said, a general state education is a mere contrivance for molding people to be exactly like one another. And as the mold in which it's cast them in is that which pleases the prominent power in the government, whether it be a monarch or a priesthood, an aristocracy, or the majority of the existing generation, in proportion to is efficient and successful, so it's like whoever's in control, if they're efficient and successful, then it establishes a despotism over the mind, leading to a natural tendency over the body. And that is exactly what we experienced in COVID. Our minds were controlled, and then our bodies, right? And that's because this is amazing. On Liberty, John Stuart Mill, read it. He talks all about public education. It's amazing. Why does this matter? I did some research, and this is scary. I'm not trying to scare you to make you cower and hide, but to scare you to motivate you. We are one of 17 republics in the history of humanity. The history of recorded humanity is 7,000 years. And there's only been 17 times that people have figured out their crap so they can govern themselves. That's it. That's it, guys. The rest of the time, we were all serfs and slaves. Unless you were lucky enough to be born to the 1% of the people who controlled everything else. 17 times. And you know what the average span life of each one of those republics was? 200 to 300 years. Okay, let's extrapolate and do some math. 1776, 2025, how many years do we have left? We could be the last generation of our republic. We really could be. But I found this really cool key. All right, there's a very famous quote, and I'm sure all of you have heard it if you've studied American Constitution, which is, September of 1778, when after the convention had happened and it created the republic, we find this story, and it says, a lady asked Dr. Franklin, well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy? A republic, replied Dr. Franklin, if you can keep it. Okay, so we just learned that republics don't last very long, and we're on the tail end of ours. So why is it that the people are required to keep it? Why is this required of the people to keep it, right? Well, so the republic, if we go back to the etymology of words, which is one of my more nerdier aspects, I love to study the root word of words, where they come from. The republic is, if you look at the definition, it's a state in which the supreme or executive power, so the ultimate honcho, the ultimate touch, is a rest in the people. We're the people in charge. Do you feel like you're in charge? I sure don't. When I look at my taxes, I sure don't. A power rests in people via representatives chosen by citizens. Okay, that's republic. And it really literally comes from the word res publica, or public interest or the state. From res affairs, so it's the public affairs. But if you take res and instead of doing res, you do rex, which is a very similar word, you get the people are kings. So either way you look at the word, it can either be it's the affairs of the people or the people are the kings. What kind of education do kings have? They have the absolute best education. Right? Because they're going to be the kings. So that every resource is given to them and everything they get, all right? We need to inspire and have a level of education equal to that of kings because we're a republic and therefore we are the power and we are the kings. And if we're not educated like kings, we can't rule. So, hold on. In order to educate our children like kings, we have to know what that looks like. So I did a little bit. I'm going to skip that. More research. And I thought to myself, who was the woman who went to talk to Benjamin Franklin? So in my mind, sometimes I picture things like in a movie. I don't know if any of you do that when you're reading a book or quote, like it's a movie in your head. Okay, I must be the only weird one. But in my movie, in my head, I was like, he was walked out of the building and this old lady, kind of like a witch, came up like, what'd you give us? And I was like, well, that probably wasn't right. No weird lady's going to walk up to him. Well, who's walking up to Benjamin Franklin? It's got to be his friend. Maybe he was accosted by old ladies in the streets, but I'm imagining it was probably his friend. So I started doing some research, and I found out the woman who asked him, what have you given us, a republic or a monarchy, was this woman right here. Her name was Elizabeth Willing Powell. And she was phenomenal, and the quote now makes amazing sense. She was the granddaughter of a regicide. Do you guys know what regicide is? No, they're the first people who thought it would be cool to kill kings. Didn't end well for them. But they were in England. There was a revolution, and if you know your English history, which you don't probably know because we're not English, but the first revolution is called the Glorious Revolution, Cromwell, they killed the king. They chopped his head off. And so they were called regicide because reg meaning king, side meaning death. Regicides. So they killed the king. And her grandfather killed the king. And then the king, the other king, came back into power. And he had to flee because he killed the king. So he came to America. And then he built his family here. So that was her grandfather. He was a king killer. And her other grandfather was one of the founders of Pennsylvania. So she had a great family history, which a lot of you all have inherited an amazing family history as well. The other thing that's really interesting about her is she had three children, and none of them survived intimacy. Her husband was the mayor of Philadelphia during the Revolutionary War. This is what I love about her, though. She was a rebel. She was not going to take... She was going to fight. That's who she was. She said, "To educate a child in such a manner as to fit her for receiving and communicating happiness is certainly the most arduous task that can devolve on female character. Yet certain it is the groundwork of education with both sexes set on the mother. She gives the first and most lasting impressions." So she was so adamant that women get educated because mothers are the most important things in the whole entire educational process. She says, "Even the language that must be taught by her is therefore properly denominated the mother tongue." Right? Because you learn to speak from your mother. And, well, we are lucky and have fathers more in our lives than they did back then. So fathers are like, "I'm going to go find a deer. See you back in 3 weeks." So it's not then that wonderful that men in all ages should be totally regardless of. She was digging at the men. She's like, "And the men don't even care to educate us, but they don't know the power we have." Okay. This is a home that she built. So it got me to thinking, what did Elizabeth Powell have in her home? So I'll go back to this. This is her home, and this home is important because why did Benjamin Franklin know her? He knew her because he had been in her home. Her home is down the street and away from a little bit from Independence Hall. All of the founding fathers who were at the convention had been in her home. She had talked with them. She had entertained them. She had given them safe places when they're far away from their family. She had a huge role. She was George Washington's very, very good friend. She was the one that convinced George Washington to serve 2 terms. This woman was not at all inactive. She was everywhere in American politics, but nobody knows her name. And that's why Benjamin Franklin said this to her. He didn't say it to, "James Madison, we really got to work on keeping this." No, he said it to this woman because he knew she had all the power. If she did her job, we could keep the republic. It was her that he was giving the power back to when he said that. "You have to keep doing what you're doing, Elizabeth. You have a home in which all these great ideas were talked about and discussed. Get in that home that you made for us, a safe haven where we could laugh and bond. And it was your home in which these ideas came from." And so that's why he said this to her and not anyone else. And then he got to thinking, well, what did Elizabeth Powell have in her home? And I realized it was a 3 in the morning idea, which sometimes are good and sometimes are not because you don't sleep anymore. But she had the first 5 freedoms that are mentioned in the Bill of Rights, which are the freedom of speech, the freedom of religion, the freedom of press, the freedom of assembly, and the freedom of petition. So he started to extrapolate from those the educational principles that are foundational to thinking, to thriving, and to being a good citizen. The first being freedom of speech. And I'm like, what does freedom of speech have anything to do with education? Like, we're all just blabbing off and being inappropriate with our teachers and, you know, because, you know, you've all said it, and I know you have, "You can't do that to me. I'm an American, and I'm free. It's a free country. I can say whatever I want." You've all said that. I know you've all said that, because that's what we believe, right? But what does that have to do with education? Okay, so this picture is kind of creepy. It's like, I mean, I have nightmares with this Russian lady on the wall. Okay. During the, I had the opportunity to live in the former Soviet Union. I don't recommend it. And this is a picture that you would see, like, plastered all over the walls of, like, really creepy alleys, because we spent time in them. Anyways. Okay, so the first time I saw this picture, though, was in actually, okay, I'm going to explain the story. In Latvia, to be the most efficient, every house was built out of concrete, and it was one pattern, and they would just, like, pour the concrete and build this building. And because the Soviets controlled it all, and so there were these creepy concrete buildings, and you'd walk into the stairwell, and then you enter a coffin that was actually supposed to be an elevator, but was more like a coffin, and if you were lucky, it would go up and down. And so you go in there, and then you'd find the floor you were trying to get to, and then you'd go. When you got to that floor, though, it's like you entered Russia Disney World. And inside of it was, like, all these crazy weird plants and, like, all kinds of interesting things, because the people couldn't plank the buildings, but they could decorate and paint the hallways. And they were all covered with these, like, every hallway was different, and you could kind of tell if it was a nice group of apartments or if it wasn't, depending on how well the hallways decorated. So one day, I was in one of those really cool, like, and when I say, like, Dr. Seuss, Disneyland, that's kind of the feel that it was. And we went and met with this lady, walked under the door, and came in, and we were having chai, and I saw this poster on the wall. This woman was so friendly. She was so nice. She'd always feed us, and she was so talkative, probably because she was lonely, but we would talk to her anyways. And she had this poster on the wall, and I said to her, what does this mean, and where does it come from? Now, I'm a really naive 21-year-old from Utah. I've never experienced any trauma in my life. And she's like, oh, I keep that as a reminder that I can talk now. I'm like, well, duh, everybody can talk now. And she's like, no, like, this is translated to don't chat, ni baltai, don't talk, don't gossip, don't chat, don't whisper, don't talk to anybody next to you, don't talk to your neighbor, don't talk to anything, because the walls are listening. And not far from it is blabbing and gossip to betrayal. So if you talk, you're going to get turned in. What happens when you get turned in? You get a one-way ticket to the gulag, if you're lucky. And so she keeps us as a reminder, because in her home now, because of communism has fallen, she can say whatever she wants. She can talk however she wants. And I was totally blown away by that, because this is the home that I grew up in. That man over there reading a book, that's my grandfather. He's 100% Swede. And that's my grandmother with my baby brother. And this is my mom right here, in the little girl right there. My grandparents had 11 children. And when I was 10, my parents bought a house, and they moved into our basement. And they lived with us my grandma lived with us for 15 years. And every Sunday, everyone would come up to have dinner, and my Swedish grandfather would sit next to my Mexican father over Taiwanese, because my dad would make Taiwanese food. And we'd have dinner. This is a picture of our dining room you can see back there. And all of us kids would sit down at the table with grandma and grandpa and my mom and dad, and my grandparents and my parents would start just talking. You can see my grandfather was always reading something. My father was always reading something. And they would talk about anything, like, oh, did you hear the book I read about, like, dinosaurs and what's going on with, like, what they're finding about whether the world is 7,000 years old, and I don't know. So, like, from there to, like, oh, yeah, Don, did you read that book about the baseball player who was, you know, like, that's what we talked about, right? And as we aged, it was expected that we would join that conversation. And my grandparents would start talking to us, and they would say things like, oh, Tati, what you reading? Nothing. Good. Well, you really should use the time God gave you to do something good. Okay, Grandpa. But one day, I was taking a Latin class, and my Latin teacher mentor had decided to take us to the Cathedral of the Madeleine, which is a very beautiful cathedral in Salt Lake, because it was they have a schedule of when they do certain masses, and it was the masses of Mary, and it was all in Latin. So we went to the Cathedral of the Madeleine, and we were all sitting at the table, and my grandfather he knew that I had gone there. And so he said to me, Tatiana, what was your experience in the Russian Mass? I mean, in the Mass for the Catholic Church. And I said, the music was so cool, and the Latin was awesome. And then I like looked at my siblings, but they're crazy over there, because they have this little like ball, and it's full of smoke, and they just throw it in your face, and then you're like breathing smoke. It's so bad. And I'm laughing with my younger siblings, and we're like, yeah, let's go to a church where they throw smoke at you. And we thought it was super funny. And my grandfather looked right at me, and he says, Tatiana, you can say whatever you want at this table. This is a free and open table. But if I ever hear you disrespect someone's faith because you're too stupid to know why they worship the way they do, I will be so mad at you. I never want to hear you say anything like that again. And my grandfather was a kind of an awkward man, but he was never a mean man. And so when he said that to me, I realized there are rules to discussion. There are rules to talking. And those rules help us learn to communicate and get along. And one of those rules is respect when you don't understand something. To respect until you do understand something and then can disagree. Since then, I know why they do the incense, and it's really fascinating and very beautiful. But my grandfather taught me how to talk, how to discuss, how to engage at the dinner table every single Sunday. We need to teach our children how to talk, because right now we have a culture where we're not allowed to talk. We're not allowed to talk. COVID destroyed my husband's family because they couldn't talk civilly about the differences they had about vaccinations. COVID did not destroy my family because even though my brother-in-law is a doctor and is very well versed in vaccinations, and I don't necessarily agree with him, we know how to talk civilly because we've practiced 1,000 times. We know how to talk. We know how to think. We know how to talk with each other so that we can come to truth together through learning to talk to each other. We don't teach that anymore because we don't allow our children to talk with us. We only talk down to them or have them regurgitate what we've told them. We don't know how to talk. And that is the first freedom in order for us to get our republic and keep it. We have to learn to talk again. And we have to start at a very young age. The next freedom I want to talk about is cultivating faith and values. I think this is extremely important. And George Washington, which is really interesting because this is George Washington, but this isn't George Washington. When George Washington, let me give you a little background. Never before had a general fought a war, had a massive amount of army and followers of military might, became the leader, and then said, okay, guys, good luck, I'll see you later. You got this one. Never before had that happened. We have examples of, like, you know, Caesar comes in, I won all that money, look at me, you should do something, wink, wink, nod, nod, oh yeah, let's make you the emperor, that's a great idea, let's do that. We have other examples, Napoleon comes in, brings in an army, oh yeah, we're gonna be free. No. So here is a man who comes up and says, okay guys, let's try this. I'm gonna hand this baton to you as the people. But before he did that, he wrote something. It was called George Washington's Farewell Address. He didn't write it. Alexander Hamilton wrote it. But he said it, and he agreed with it. So we're going to count that. Okay, this is what he says. Of all the dispositions and habits that lead to political prosperity, so of every single thing, every checklist you could ever make that would make us happy and like politically doing well, religion and morality are indispensable. So every single thing you have out there, doesn't matter. If you don't have a religion, a morality, it's not going to stand. In vain would the man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness. It's like, if you call yourself a patriot, but you're not rooting for moral teaching and religiosity, you're not a patriot. Sorry. This is George Washington. This isn't my words. He says, the mere politician, equally with the pious man, ought to respect and cherish them. A volume could not trace all their connections with private and public facility. Let it simply be asked, where is the security for property, for reputation, for life, if the sense of religious obligation deserts the oath that are instruments of investigations in the courts? So what he's saying is, where's our security when our people no longer have faith? What's going to keep you from keeping your items safe from getting stolen or the law being upheld if we no longer have faith? There's nothing there. It won't happen. And I'll tell you what, y'all are really blessed to live here in Idaho because I think you have a lot of people who are still on the faith train. But where I live, nobody's on the faith train. I feel like. And we have so many problems with theft, with law breaking, with everything you can imagine. And in turn then, we have poverty, real starvation, because we can't keep things from being stolen. So we can't grow, so we can't be prosperous. There's real consequences for us not doing these things, and George Washington's telling them to us. Let us, with caution, indulge the supports that morality can be maintained without religion. It's not true. If you don't have a structure, you cannot be a good people. Whatever may be conceded in the mind education on proper of minds of particular structure, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion from religious principles. That was George Washington. I only have 10 minutes left. Okay, all right. This is really fascinating. And this is why in your home, religious or moral principles have to be in your curriculum somehow. Because where anything is growing, one former is worth 1,000 reformers. Oh, I have to 545. Okay, thank you. So this is, anyone know who that man is? Horace Mann? Come on, guys. Anyone know that? He's like the evil man. You know who Horace Mann is? He's the father of public schools. He's the father of the system. And this is what he's saying. Where anything is growing, like a kid's mind, it's better to have one person cultivating it than someone trying to change it when they're older. One former is worth 1,000 reformers. So let's get in there when they're little. Okay, the next one is freedom of press. Okay, this one I thought was really interesting because, like, what is the freedom of press? Well, because we already talked about we have to be able to speak, and that's really important, and we have to have strong moral values. But what is press? How does press involve or be part of our child's education? Like, okay, I know, well, I'll make a subscription to the New York Times, and then we'll read, we'll get some conservative ones, like maybe the New Republic or some, I don't know, the Blaze, and then we'll read that for school. Oh, good job, we checked that. No, that's not what it worked. That's what it means. It means empowering literacy and critical media skills. That's what it means. So there's a great book called The Great Conversation, which is in the Great Book series. We've had some awesome presentations on that. Go read that book. It's really awesome. But this is an excerpt from it. I've already shared this before, but we believe that the reduction of the citizen to an object of propaganda, private and public, is one of the greatest dangers to democracy. The greatest dangers we face is propaganda. How much propaganda have you seen in the last week? 100 pieces? Everyone should be raising your hand if you've seen any ads at all. If anything, you've been on social media or you've been anywhere, you've seen thousands of pieces of propaganda every week. Thousands, unless you're really good and you never get on your computer. So a prevalent notion is that the great mass of the people cannot understand and cannot form independent judgment. It's okay because y'all are stupid. You don't need to think. You can't even think. You really can't think. So they cannot be educated. In the sense of developing their intellectual powers, let's just give them skills and let them do a job because they're too stupid. The retention of slogans, or the reiteration of slogans, the distortion of the news, the great storm of propaganda that beats upon the citizen 24 hours a day, all his life long, means that either the democracy must fall prey to the loudest and most persistent propagandists, or that the people must save themselves by strengthening their minds. You can save yourself so that they can appraise the issues for themselves. This is what the freedom of the press means. You have to know what is coming to you that is good or bad. You have to be able to discern this. And most people can't do that because you haven't been taught how to do that. We don't teach that. So how do we teach that? We get a liberal education through the liberal arts. The aim of liberal education is human excellence, both private and public, for man is a political animal. Its object is the excellence of man as man and man as citizen. It regards man as an end, not a means. You're not just a person making a paycheck. And it regards the ends of life, not the means of it. What are we working for when we get to be 80? I love Jordan Peterson because he talks about this all the time. You're living life great now, but someday you're going to be 80. What are you going to have? You got to really think about that, right? And so he says, other types of education or training treat men as, for this reason, it is the education of the free men. Other types of education or training treat men as means to some other ends, or at best are concerned with the means of life, the learning and living, and not with its ends. The substance of a liberal education appears to consist in the recognition of basic problems, in knowledge of distinctions and interrelations in subject matter, and in the comprehension of ideas. So liberal arts education is what you need to have. Now, most parents are, okay, how am I going to do this for my kids? I'm sorry, but you can't give what you don't have. Maybe if I could, I could create like the ultimate energy source, like create something from nothing. That'd be, I'd be like a superhero. But you literally cannot give your children an education if you don't have one. So parents, if you don't have one, you need to get one. And you can do it with your kids. My mom was as dumb as bricks when she married my dad, and she will tell you that to you any day. It's funny now, because my mom is no longer dumb as bricks. She's literally the smartest person I know. But she started as dumb as bricks. She was so dumb, she said that she had never read a book when she married my dad. And my dad would come home every day from every Monday for a break. He would take all of us kids to the library. That was our daddy date every Monday. And my mom would stay home and just not be with little kids. So he'd come home and he would put a book on her nightstand and say, "What could I got for you, Melody? You should look at this one." And she'd be like, "I'm not going to read a book, Dawn. I don't have time for that." And eventually he would just keep doing that and keep doing that. And finally my mom started reading. And she was like, "Oh, it's not too bad." You know, first it was like historical fiction romance. And then it got more and more, and now my mom has the most phenomenal education. Mentored by John Taylor Gatto. She has two master's degrees. She's brilliant, but she started out as dumb as bricks. So if you are starting out as dumb as bricks, you're in great company. Okay? Oh, let's see. I don't have time for this. Yeah. Okay. Thing I want to do. Okay. The method of liberal education is the liberal arts, and the result of a liberal education is a discipline in those arts. The liberal artist learns to read, write, speak, listen, understand, and think. He learns to reckon, measure, and manipulate matter, quantity, and the motion in order to predict, produce, and exchange. As we live in the tradition, whether we know it or not, so we're all liberal artists, whether we know it or not. We all practice the liberal arts well or badly all the time, every day. So you don't get a choice. This is what we are. So you can either be really, really bad or you can be really, really good. But you don't get to choose anything else. The liberal arts are not merely indispensable. They are unavoidable. Nobody decides whether he's going to be a human. I'm going to wake up. I'm going to be a dog. That's a dumb choice. And you can't. Okay, so nobody can decide whether he'll be a human. The only question open is whether he will be an ignorant, undeveloped one, or one who has sought to reach the highest point he is capable of attaining. Those are the two choices you have every day when you roll out of bed. Those are the two choices you have. The question, in short, is whether you will be a poor liberal artist or a good one. That's the only question you get to answer when you roll out of bed. Am I going to be really good at being a human today, or am I going to really suck? And you know, some days you can wake up and you can suck, and that's okay. I wake up that quite a lot. All right, so the second one, I know I'm going really fast, and I have a lot to cover, so hopefully your brains are turning into zombie mush. But the build meaningful communities. Now, this comes from freedom of assembly. That was one of the most painful things of COVID. They shut our churches down. They shut our parks down. They shut every building down. They shut everywhere we could gather. And we just sat there and let them do it. We just sat there and let them do it. Because we didn't have a choice. We couldn't have chosen anything else. We don't have the education to say, hold on, I have critical thinking skills and media skills. I can filter all this propaganda and I can see what's happening because I have been educated and I can see this is very similar to what happened in Nazi Germany. Very similar. I don't want to do that, so I'm going to say no. We didn't do that because we couldn't, because we didn't know. So I'm not saying all of y'all are evil for not doing something, but we need to get an education so next time it happens, because we will have ability to choose. Now, what does assembly have to do with education? This is the pyramid of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Now, we all want to get to the top of the pyramids. My father-in-law climbed to the top of the pyramids. He was doing it illegal. He was a young, stupid kid. But, because now you would go to jail forever. But we all want to get to the top of the pyramids. That's the goal. Like, you want, everyone wants to be the top of the pyramid, right? So we want self-actualization. That's what we want to have. We want to have this. But in order to get this, you have to build the bottom. Unless you figured out how to float things in anti-gravity, we have that at bottom. So we need psychological or physiological needs. We all need to breathe, and food and water. We all need emotional needs being met. But the next one above that is we all need friendship. We all need it. There are some few of us who can do one friend and they're good, right? But for the most of us, we all need friends, plural. And we need a sense of connection. You're not going to build that in your home if you're isolated all the time. It's not going to happen. You have to be actively building community. I'm going to tell you a story about this. Sometimes my church asks us to do things that are insanely uncomfortable. I'm a high introvert. Talking to people is really, really not my thing. Why am I here? All right, so I was serving my church, and I was the leader of the youth, and it was Christmas time, and everyone was like, we should give a present to our teachers because they're so awesome. And so I was procrastinating it because, anyways, I didn't get it done before Christmas. So now I had to go to every single person's house and deliver the present. Otherwise, I'd have a bag full of presents with no one to give them to. So I went to one of our teachers' house. He was a very old man by the name of Brother Gillenwater, and he's 74 years old. And I go up to his house, and I say, hey, Merry Christmas. We just want to say thank you so much for serving. And then he had his mother, who had never been to church, never there, and she's 91 or 93 at the time, and she's like, come on in, come on in. Steve talks all about you all the time. Come on in. So I can sit down and I meet his wonderful 92-year-old grandma, his mother. And she had the saddest life. During World War II, her parents abandoned her and she was put into foster care. And she lost track of all of her siblings. So she was the only child. She married to Steve's father. He was abusive. And he abandoned her as a single mother. She raised that man to be the most loving, kind, amazing man. And we had the opportunity as a family to start going over to their house and getting to know Claudia. And my kids fell in love so quickly with her. And it blew my mind how gracious and loving and kind she could be when so many horrible things had happened to her in her life. She would make the most amazing food, and we would come and she'd tell us stories, and we'd watch the squirrels together and chase birds, and just really fun little things that my kids and I would do with her. Well, she fell down this last June, and 93, so we knew time would be coming to an end. And we went to go visit her, and she was in her bed, and we were sitting, I was sitting on the bed. I have a four-year-old and a six-year-old boys, and they're crazy. I was feeling really bad that I was bringing these crazy, rambunctious boys to her in deathbed, in essence, but we really wanted to see her. And my six-year-old, before we leave, comes up to me, whispers in my ears, "Mommy, can I go hold her?" And I said, "Yeah, you can go hold her." And he crawls up into her bed, and she got the biggest smile I have ever seen. And she was so happy, and he just held her. And he just snuggled her. And shortly, 4 days later, she died. And that was the last time that she was held. And I would have never had the opportunity to do that if I wasn't part of a community that demanded of me to serve and demanded of me to have connection, longing. And my little boy was so happy. We walked out, I said, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "I just really wanted to show her that I loved her." You have to fight for those experiences for your children. You have to be willing to be extremely uncomfortable. Because I don't like going up to people's houses, even if I'm bringing food or something. That is so uncomfortable for me. I don't like going to meet strangers. But because I was willing to fight, because I knew my kids need community, I knew that they needed these things, I fought for them, and I helped my son learn how to love. The last one is the freedom to petition. We need to be active and take action. This is a picture of my daughter at the in April. It was the end of April. We went to it was very scary because no one was going, but we decided we were just going to go to a rally that they were holding at the Capitol building in Salt Lake, even though it was illegal and there was lockdowns. And I wanted to go, even though it was illegal and it was scary and no one was going anywhere, because I wanted to have this picture of Sarah, and I wanted to show her that I said, even in the darkest times, when we were mourning because of things that happened to us, Mommy and Daddy choose to face the prospect of getting arrested so we can show people. This is what it means to be America. We're free. You can't take these rights away from us. So I took this picture. The sign, you can't read it, says, I'm a survivor of a coronavirus suicide. And a relative of that. And this is my little girl. But this is what this quote is from Shakespeare. And when I read this, I'm pretty sure I was in college when I read this, it really hit me super hard. Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we might win. I think the biggest thing that we struggle with parents is we doubt ourselves. We doubt things. Okay, I gotta go. This, I want to close with this quote. It's absolutely amazing. I found this, it's a letter. Abigail Adams was writing this letter to her friend, and her friend was like, "I really don't know what I'm doing. I kind of feel like I'm a bad parent and I can't figure this out." And this is a letter Adams wrote. She's so cool. She said, "When I saw the happy fruits of your attention in your well-ordered family, I felt a sort of illumination glowing in my bosom to imitate the," and this is her poem. I'm like, I would never write a letter like that. "Hey, Megan, when I visited your amazing family, I just felt like writing a poem. Like, it's so cool." Anyways, parent whose vast pleasure finds in forming of their children's minds, in midst of whom with vast delight she passes many a winter's night, mingles in every play to find what bias nature gave the mind, resolving thence to take her aim to guide them to the realms of fame, and wisely make those realms the way to everlasting day, each boisterous passion to control and early humanize the soul in simplest tales besides the fire, the noblest notions to inspire her offspring conscious of her care, transported Hayne upon her chair. Going back to Elizabeth Winning Powell, Benjamin Franklin was talking to a woman who was a mother. I know all of you aren't mothers, but all of you were raised by a mother, and all of you were influenced by the home in which your parents built and the home in which you were part of. This is how we keep a republic. He was talking to her because he understood the power in keeping a republic is in the homes we build. It's in how we shape our children's minds in the homes we build. You have the power so that we can breathe again as a nation. It's all within your power. You do not need to live in fear. You do not need to ever be afraid again, because you have the power. And that's what everyone out there, the big bad, whoever it is, they don't want you to realize that. They want you to feel like you have no choice, that you have no ability. You have the power to liberate our nation.
That's right.
Thank you.